Thank you very much. Thank you. Amazing to find such a young audience. Everybody is younger than I am. Even younger, I should have said. Well, when I was invited to participate in this, I was amazed when Claire Jones, no relation, she said, just do whatever you like, do what you feel like doing. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this because I really haven't had the opportunity to do that very often, certainly not at the BBC. And I finally decided I wouldn't try and tell any jokes or try and be funny. I would just tell you a few of the events and adventures that I've had since I started, and I'll try and tell them as truthfully as I can. Sometimes it may be amusing, sometimes not. But anyway, to begin with, I must tell you a bit about my background, which was started in show business 60 years ago. So long before that, I lived in a small town in Shropshire called Wem, which always embarrassed me. It was such a ridiculous name, W-E-M. And with my name Jones and everything, I felt it was a bad start, you know. I would like to have been called Conrad Rittblatt or something like interesting, you know. But it was 2,000 or 3,000 people. And at the time, in the 20s, there were motor cars, I hasten to tell you, but most of the vehicles were horse-drawn. The people came to the house with the butcher, the baker, the fishmonger, the coal man. Everybody had horse-drawn vehicles, except the man who brought watercress, who was on a bicycle. And I remember even the fire engine was horse-drawn. And they had a little shed near the brewery for the fire engine, which looked like Stevenson's rocket, rather. And I remember once when there was a fire alarm in the distance, and it was the workhouse, which was, ironically, not far from where we lived. Embarrassingly close, in fact. But there was no horse on this occasion. They usually borrowed a horse from the brewery, you see, where they used them to pull the beer about in barrels. And so when I saw the fire engine coming towards me with a crowd of people cheering, the firemen were actually pulling it. They were in the shafts. And the local comedian was captain of the fire brigade, and he was sitting on top, waving his hat and enjoying it all enormously. Of course, when they got there, the fire was out, as normally normally happened. Now, the nicest thing about this town was the grammar school, which I attended and enjoyed enormously for the first 10 years of my life. And the biggest thing there was the athletics. I had no real aptitude for it, and still haven't. But I enjoyed it enormously. And when sports day came round, I always entered every event, even though I was wildly unsuitable for most of them. And the event on the occasion I'm going to tell you about was the mile race. Now, I was, I think, 7 or 8, I may have been, when I entered for this, and all the other boys were 18 or so, and twice my size. And anyway, we lined up, and off they went, left me standing, and I started and ran as well as I could. But by the time I was one lap round, they'd done two, and so they kept passing me, you see. And I got to about the fourth or fifth lap, there were 6 altogether, and I heard people cheering and clapping the winner, and the second, and the third, in the distance, miles away. But I carried on and went along. I eventually got into the straight, and as I approached the tape, I heard people cheering, you see. So I finished, breasted the tape, and everybody made a tremendous fuss, like a standing ovation. And the next day, after prayers, the headmaster was a very cozy, lovely old man, as indeed all the masters were so nice. And he made a little speech about me and the grit and determination that I displayed and how I refused to give up, persevered, and, you know, blah, 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 went on like this. And eventually presented me with a small silver cup, or silver-plated, egg cup. which I still have. It's unfortunately in storage at the moment because we're moving. Otherwise, I would have brought it with me just to prove that I'm telling you the truth. Well, now, to me, the interesting thing is about this event, was it really grit and determination and all those qualities that the headmaster had described, or did I have some slight beginning of an instinct for theatrical effect? Now, I've never been able to decide which it was, and because I haven't been to an analyst, it would have taken years to determine which it was, so I've come to the conclusion it was a combination of both, a bit of both, you know. Well, eventually I was sent away to boarding school because my grandmother left a few hundred pounds, a very modest amount, and my mother managed to get me into this boarding school, which I think is listed as a public school, but a very minor one. I'm not going to tell you anything about that. I was there 2 years, but too many people have written books and described the agonies and horrors of being in a boarding school that I'll spare you that altogether. Suffice to say that after 2 horrific years, I had a bit of luck. I got TB. And it was a life-threatening disease at that time, and my parents were very worried. But I was whisked away from the school and into a sanatorium where I stayed for a year. And that was wonderful. It was an education because I met so many entirely different people, you see. There were miners and sailors. The conditions in the Navy were really almost as bad as I'd endured at the boarding school. With the result that many of them were ill, starved to death, and dreadful atmospheres. But I started putting on shows because I seemed to be much better than anybody else there. In fact, I got better almost overnight as soon as I left the school. And I used to listen to the radio a lot, as we all did, and I used to crib a lot of the sketches, plays and things, write them, and always had leading parts for myself. And I bullied these other people who were quite often frail and unable to argue. And with great good nature, they took part in these things, and I developed a taste for it, you see. And at the end of each show, I used to write a review of it, which I submitted to the local paper. And they printed it under another name. Well, this is an opportunity that has never arisen since I sat to say. So eventually I said goodbye to the sanatorium, and the lovely nurse who used to give me the most amazing kisses before I went to sleep. And then I went home, and I was not entirely cured, because I had to, for 10 or 20 years, I think, I had to go every month and be x-rayed and to see if there was any recurrence. But I started writing to repertory companies, because I knew that was the way to go on the stage. And eventually I got a reply from Wolverhampton, which was a bit of luck, because we had relatives there. And in fact, in the summer, my mother used to take me to Wolverhampton as a kind of summer holiday. Curious place to go, but the relatives were very hospitable, and I always had a lovely time. It was a big city to me. I'd never been anywhere as big as that. And then I went to see the producer at the repertory company, who'd said he'd give me a few minutes, and he explained that they did, from time to time, employ young men and women as ASMs. And they used to sweep the stage, he said, make tea, coffee, whatever. And then if 2 or 3 lines in a play came up, they'd give them a chance to play the part. And he said, we've got a play with 2 or 3 lines in it in a fortnight's time. But it really, it's the part of a Times reporter. And you are, how old do you say? 22, I said, 22. I was actually 17, but I felt I was 22, and he accepted that. And he said, you see, we wanted really something rather heavier, more substantial altogether, but never mind. If you think you can do it, please come on the day. Don't come the week before, because there's no need to rehearse these 4 lines. And we can do it during the day of the opening. It was a twice nightly theatre, 6:15 and 8:45, I think, something like that. And bearing in mind what he'd said about the physique of the Times reporter, I borrowed a suit from my Uncle Harry, who was about 18 stone. And he was a huge man and a lovely man. He was so nice to me. I can't tell you how generous he was. And he was a bit of a card, too, which always amused me because he could do conjuring tricks and sleight of hand and tell jokes, and he could describe the shows he'd seen in London. He travelled a lot, and some of the shows that he described were more vivid from his description than they were if you went to see the show, and a lot funnier very often. I could go on about my Uncle Harry a long time, but I won't. But this is an example. He took me to the pictures as the war was coming to an end, and it said over the entrance, "Forces half price," and he put down half the price of admission, said "Secret Service," and was immediately admitted. Now, the show. They gave me a script which was half a page of typescript, because nobody could afford to have whole plays typed for every character in a play. So they just had the cue line, or sometimes only half of the cue line, in one colour, black or red, and the actor's line underneath it. And there were four altogether, which I learned at home and practised pushing pillows down the front of the trousers from my Uncle Harry, and because that wasn't enough, I wound a velvet curtain round that, you know, and then eventually was able to do it in front of a mirror. So the day came, and off I went to Wolverhampton and reported at the theatre at 10 o'clock, as they told me, and the stage doorkeeper said, room 38. So I went upstairs on the fourth floor. It was the chorus dressing room, in fact, and I was alone in it. And remained so, because the other actors had the better rooms below. And I got into the gear, the pillows, the stuff, the curtain round here and everything, and then the tannoy said, "Costume parade downstairs immediately." So off I went, and I came face to face with the producer who'd engaged me. And he nearly had a stroke. And he said, "What's the idea?" And I didn't have to explain. He said, "Yes, of course, I said he was bigger than you, didn't I, and more substantial." Well, he said, "What did you wear when you arrived?" I said, "Well, I just had flannels and a jacket, you know." He said, "Wear that. Perfect, perfect. It'll suit you so much better." So I went back upstairs and changed and waited. It was now, I suppose, probably about 11, and that was a long time before 6:15, and I wondered when I'd be asked to rehearse. But I wasn't asked. So I waited, and eventually they called the third act. So I groped my way to the door through which I knew I would have to go to get onto the stage and give my four lines. And it was a very long wait, but I waited, and then eventually I heard the cue. And I thought, I don't want to make any mistake about this. So I had another look at the script. Yes, I was quite right. So I opened the door slightly, and I could see the leading man, who was alone on the stage, and he wasn't just waiting for me, he was praying somebody would go on, because minutes had passed since the cue line. And so I pulled the knob of the door, you see, and it didn't give. Pulled a bit harder, even harder, and eventually very hard, and I heard the sound of splintering wood. And eventually, rather slowly, it dawned on me that the door didn't pull, it pushed. So I pushed and lurched onto the stage. Now, once I'd got about a yard away from the door, I saw all these lights. I'd never experienced anything like it. In the amateur shows that I'd taken part in, they usually had a light hanging down in the middle of the stage, and that was it. But the lights were all around the circle, and there were spotlights shining from the top and the sides, and I just stared at them, absolutely paralysed, like a rabbit looking into the motor car headlights. And I thought, I've got to say this line. Couldn't speak. I couldn't utter. Nothing. And after what seemed like 1,000 years, I heard my lines being spoken by somebody on the other side of the stage. And it was the other reporter, whom I didn't even know existed. And after he'd finished and I had not spoken, the curtain came down and everybody lined up. And I found I was next to the leading man, which was embarrassing for him particularly. And he kind of gave me a sharp nudge in the ribs. And so I stepped back and they closed ranks. And then I thought I must appear somewhere, I suppose. nobody would let me in, you see. But eventually I found a little space at the very end. And the curtain came down and we all bowed and that was that. And nobody spoke to me. The other actors, whom I'd not met at all, you know, they might have just said something, but they didn't. And they kind of found things to look at in other directions. Very embarrassing. So I climbed back upstairs and waited. And eventually the producer came up. And I must say, he was awfully nice and patient. And he said, I didn't realize you were quite as inexperienced as you are. But he said, look, you didn't know anything about the play because we weren't able to rehearse. But he said, I tell you what, if you'd like, I'll give you a ticket to watch the second house because we have an actor who's come from Birmingham and he can do your part tonight in the second house, which he did. And so I was able to watch from the circle. It was the shortest engagement I've had. First house, Monday, and that was the finish. Well, I wasn't unduly depressed. I mean, I didn't ever doubt that I would eventually be able to be an actor. So I progressed into one or two fit-up companies where they did 3 plays in a week, if you can believe it. 2 days, 2 days, 2 days, different plays. Well, I'm just going to tell you this story, which is rather unsavory. There are some rather unpleasant aspects to it. But I dare say you're fairly worldly people. You'll be able to understand. I was in this repertory company where there was one very small toilet, which was shared by the audience and the actors. There was a door for each on either side of the proscenium. So when you went in, whichever door it was, you had to make sure the other one was locked. Otherwise, you might be playing Hamlet and somebody from the audience walks in and sees you sitting there, and it's unnerving for them. Anyway, this particular week, I was playing the part of an impresario, and they hired an Astrakhan coat and provided me with a cigar, and I played this part of a man who was putting on a play. So it was a play within a play, you see. And after the first act, somebody came back from the lavatory and they said, has anybody been there in the last half hour? No. Come and have a look. So we all went. And there in the pan was something the like of which you have never seen. It didn't look as though it had been produced by a human being. I mean, I don't know, we used to call, all kind of euphemisms were used when I was little, like plops and number two. And my wife, being American, said big go-go. That's what it was always called as a children. And it was huge. People kept pulling the chain. Nothing happened. It was like a bag of cement that has been left out in the rain and solidified over the winter. So the actors for the second act had to go across to the pub, to the lavatory there, as did many of the audience, I imagine. So the play is put on and the third act begins with the other actors all sitting around on the floor reading the notices, which were apparently very good. And then I appear, and I say, boys and girls, this is the biggest thing I've ever had on my hands. And I'm going to take it to New York. And it'll run for years. Well, of course, by this time, they were all helpless with laughter. The actors. I mean, they couldn't, neither could I, when I realized, you know, what it was all about. And it's embarrassing, and really is, for actors when that happens, because they realise the audience are sitting there. They can't understand why are they all laughing? And, of course, they never knew. Well, maybe one of them did. Anyway, after a while, I got a wonderful break, and that was to be in a play that was going to Broadway for Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were really the most successful producers in the world at the time. And they were doing a play by Graham Greene and Basil Dean. Now, Basil Dean was famous and most successful theatrical producer, both in America and in London. Unfortunately, he had a rather unpleasant personality sometimes. In fact, he was described by a lot of people as a sadist because he did reduce people to tears, actors, particularly ladies. In fact, if you were rehearsing and wanted to go to the lavatory, you had to make sure there was nobody in there already sobbing their heart out. Anyway, he rehearsed. And Rodgers and Hammerstein didn't interfere. They just came and sat at the very back, and they were it was very pleasant and invited us to several little parties and things. But the play ran about 2 hours too long. And so Oscar Hammerstein said, "I'm sorry, we've got to make drastic cuts." He said, "Peter, scene one, out." And I said, "But, Mr." He said, "Sorry, no time to argue. We can't discuss it even. We're up against it." And the result of this was that since I was playing the part of the spy, I was never introduced as far as the audience were concerned. And they never knew until even at the end of the play who I was. Because I acted mysteriously, you know. And so that was that. And they said, after the second night, I think, "We're finishing Saturday." And this was, I should have mentioned, it was in Boston. So we never actually got to Broadway at all, in spite of all the publicity there'd been. And it was very disappointing, except that I did meet the lady who, some considerable time later, was to become my wife. 42 years ago, this is. So I came back, not knowing what I was going to do, but the BBC, in the interval, I'd asked Peter Ustinov if he'd do a show of improvisations, which he was very good at, and we used to do them together because we were in two plays together. And in spite of making each other laugh rather too much and getting hysterics, we did invent these characters with different accents, dialects. Most actors do this kind of thing just to pass the time when they're having a drink or whatever, you know. And so we had a lot of characters, including two spivs, as they were called in those days, street traders, who were always trying out new schemes to try and outwit the rest of the population. Well, we'd got little bits, you see, but we didn't know how to get them together. And Frank Muir and Dennis Norden were, at that time, comedy advisors at the BBC, and they were able to invent a situation for us, which was we were driving around in a car looking for an address in Copthorne Avenue. And we never found it, but when we passed the Albert Hall, we were able to do impressions of musicians discussing what they were going to play, or if it was the London Clinic, then it would be doctors, and it became very well known, the address, I mean. And the show went very well, and we did three series of it. And at the end of the third series, I'd got a bit disenchanted, not with Peter, because I just thought he was a genius, and I still do. But I thought, I can't be identified with him forever. You know, I've got to kind of strike out on my own. And it became embarrassing when somebody would ring up and invite me to something, and then after a little conversation they would reveal that it was rather on condition that I brought him with me, which is not good for the ego at all. But anyway, I did go along with the idea of doing a television pilot, and I said, well, this is it, we just do one show on television and then I'm going to leave, not do any more. We did it, and it was very successful, and they were very keen to do a series of it. And I had to try and explain how I felt about my association with him, you see. So I told the audience, I said, I'd had a dream, and I dreamt that I was in the Mall at some big public event, like a Jubilee or Royal Marriage or something, and the crowds of people, and we're all looking towards the Buckingham Palace gates, and we're waiting for the royal coach to come out, which eventually it did. A huge cheer went up, the Windsor Greys trundled out, and after about 100 yards, everybody gasped, because the leading horse had obviously slipped its bit, I think it's called, and was running wild, and it affected the other five. And the coachman fell off, and everybody was aghast. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh were in this coach. And so I jumped over with one amazing leap over the soldiers and the policemen, stood in the centre of the... this is a dream, by the way. and waited, and when my moment came, I seized the leading horse and managed to wrench its head round until it was on the ground. And by this time, I was bleeding and in a terrible state. And then the Queen got out of the coach and walked over. She didn't know me from Adam, of course, but she said, Peter, you've saved our lives. God bless you. And then she took the sword from the Duke of Edinburgh and put it on my shoulder, and she said, arise, Sir Peter. And then I passed out. And I realized I had died. Well, after a pause, I find I'm on a cloud. And I think a very weird feeling. And I look down and I see that I'm over Piccadilly Circus. And everywhere people are clambering around the people selling newspapers. I think, my God, I've really emerged in my own right at last, finally, you know, after what I'd done. And I managed to, like somebody dog paddling, to bring this cloud closer and closer to the entrances to the tubes where the newspapers were. And eventually I was able to read one of the posters. And it said, Peter Ustinov, bereaved. Well, that was... actually, it wasn't a dream. I made it up. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I think you've been a wonderful audience, considering there aren't all that many of you, though you have filled all the seats available. One would have wished it was bigger. But nevertheless, you've been so warm and responsive and jolly. Thank you very much, and have a good day. Bye-bye.
That Reminds Me with Peter Jones was produced by Claire Jones.